Now there are a few other points I want to make from Mascavige which shed light on this issue. On page 218, he again makes the point about what is probable. He says, quote, "The true test of this probability, one must insist, is whether or not such a doubt of fact can be defended in the external forum as warranting the assent of a prudent man," end quote. So again, we see his reference to whether a prudent man would consider this reasonable in regard to assessing whether something is a legitimate doubt of fact or a legitimate doubt of law. He mentions in that quote a doubt of fact, but he applies the same criteria for assessing what is probable in reference to a doubt of law and common error. On page 104, Mascavige says something which is again very relevant to the purpose of law, and especially canon law. Quote, "As the centuries passed, there was a remarkable and steady growth and clarification of the jurist's conviction that the supreme legislator would not exact the strict fulfillment of the jurisdictional laws and requirements if, when, and as such rigid enforcements were to redound to the general harm of the subjects," end quote. So that's a key principle, that if the laws start to hurt the common good and the faithful, if they are to be strictly interpreted and rigidly enforced in a situation which the legislator did not envision, then they are not to be rigidly enforced and interpreted. Now the next point I want to talk about is something that I marked in my notes called a flawed and weak science, and it refers to essentially how these theologians and even Mascavige cannot come to a conclusion on this issue. It's amazing when you read this work, it's 300 and some pages, and he goes through all kinds of theologians, citing all kinds of scholars on this side, that side, and he cannot give you a simple synthesized conclusion for all of this knowledge and all of this research about how and where the church will specifically supply jurisdiction. As we've covered, he enunciates and admits many principles which devastate the no jurisdiction position. However, in many questions about whether the church will supply jurisdiction here, he doesn't know, and all he can advance is a probable opinion. And I want to give some examples of that and explain why this is significant. Mascavige says that the church will supply when there is common error, but he's not sure when there would be common error. On pages 124 and 5, he discusses the issue. Quote, "In the first place, so they contend, who will determine what figure will satisfactorily fulfill the requisite number of those in error for it to be common error? Certainly the authors are not in agreement on this score. Even those who have made a real attempt at greater clarity and practicability by admitting that the error of many will suffice are not agreed about how and when many may be said to be in error. Consequently, because of such uncertainty and vagueness in regard to this essentially important condition, the interpretive school of canonists firmly contends that it is not permissible to agree that the Church has intended to subordinate the validity of her absolutions, etc., to a norm so inadequately clear, so vague, so practically impossible to determine with any degree of assurance. In the second place, granting for the sake of argument only that a definite figure or a percentage has been agreed upon, even then one will not always find it a simple task to ascertain the presence of the error of the necessary number of people. For, certainly it would be necessary to distinguish those in error from those who are in mere ignorance, and then those who are truly in error from those whose error is crass and supine. It would be necessary to exclude the non-baptized of a certain locale, and it would be not clear as to whether the 20, 30, or 40% of the non-practicing Christians should be included or excluded. Such indeed are some of the difficulties arrayed against the wisdom of requiring the error to be real and common in the strict and traditional sense." End quote. So we can see that he doesn't offer any conclusion about specifically what is common error. He does the same thing about probable doubt of fact or law, except for the fact that he advances the opinion of many scholars who say that if it's probable, if a prudent man would determine that there is a doubt of fact or law, then the church will supply jurisdiction. But he is quite nebulous in assessing these questions and giving his strict opinion on this. And so, frankly, I have to say that this is an exercise in foolishness. For if you can write a 300-page book and consult all of these different scholars and array all of these different opinions and bring all of this different evidence and not synthesize all of your research, all the time, all of the thought you've put into this, into a simple conclusion that people can work with, that the faithful can grasp, that can be utilized to help make decisions in practical life, then it's pointless. It's just one big intellectual endeavor which profits nothing. It's ever learning and never coming to the knowledge of the truth, 2 Timothy 3:7. And sadly, this Mashkevich, who published his work around 1940, I don't know, but probably was a Salvation heretic, as most of the priests at the time were. And so it really struck me how this is really a pointless endeavor on his part, because he doesn't give us a conclusion for many of these critical questions. And this is the type of intellectual nonsense that a lot of these bad-willed people, especially in the traditional movement today, and even in the decades leading up before Vatican II, fell into. It was all about, you know, the complexity of the arguments, the deep intellectual discussions, the scholarly research, but not coming to a simple conclusion. And that's where the devil deceives them, because the truth is simple, and God is ultimately simple. And it's not smart, it's not intelligent, to spend all of this time and assess all of these opinions and then not come to a conclusion. That's called stupid. And that is foolishness, that is bad will, that is not wisdom. And you can come to a conclusion. And I have to say, frankly, that we instinctively had a conclusion that was correct and actually borne out by the principles he enunciates in his work before even reading his work. And so, frankly, a Catholic's instinct can tell him more with certainty than Mashkevich does after all of his research. Namely, that if there is any reasonability to assume that there is a doubt of fact or a doubt of law, or that the Church wouldn't bind you in this situation, and you're not acting directly against Church law, the Church will supply the jurisdiction. If he were of goodwill, he could have synthesized his research into that conclusion, but he doesn't. He lists principles and says things which prove that, but he remains in a fog and he's very murky about asserting his own position on precisely how to apply a lot of these questions. Here's another quote from pages 126 and 7, which illustrates the point I'm talking about. Quote, "The very purpose of law, to provide for the common good of the faithful. Such was the ultimate reason for Buccheroni's defection from the traditionally accepted opinion on common error. He could not reconcile himself to the belief that the Church would say that a number of successive individual absolutions would be invalid, and that at a certain time after these instances of invalidity, the Church would begin to supply the deficient jurisdiction. Why the borderline case should profit at the expense of so many invalid absolutions seemed to jar Buccheroni's concept of the benignity of the Church. It also seemed quite an anomaly to him that in the borderline case, that is, as soon as the error of many had actually been verified, the Church would consider the common good involved, but would not do so in any of the cases which preceded. This objection of Buccheroni can easily be seen perpetuated in the works of innumerable authors who followed him in this view. Thus, for example, Wernz Vidal substantially reiterate Buccheroni's thesis, insisting that the Church could not be said to supply for the common good if she did not supply until after many have already suffered from invalid confessions. They add that very often the sufficient number may be reached only at such a time when there is little, if any, use for the remedy." End quote. Here's another interesting quote from page 80, which further illustrates the point about how you can't really put a limit on it. Quote, "However, even if one could accurately determine that after such and such a time, common error actually were present, would it not be true that the benignity of the Church would not benefit those persons who received absolution before the error had actually been committed by a sufficient number of people to become common? Furthermore, once the error had actually become common, undeniably the first person who thereafter received absolution would be validly absolved. But Buccheroni could not see how the required conditions of common error and common good could be considered to coexist in the case of such a single individual. In view of such difficulties, Bucaroni discarded the theory which required actual error. Instead, he taught that the requirements of the common error and of the public good were fulfilled from the very first absolution of the priest, end quote. And so Mascavige goes on about how do we know when exactly something is a common error so that then the church will supply? Doesn't that seem unfair to the very last person who had his confession heard prior to the error actually becoming common? And the answer is, this is all nonsense, that the church will supply it for any of those who acted reasonably, as long as they didn't act clearly against church law and in a manner which was really without excuse and demonstrated grave neglect of church teaching and church law. And that's proven by their confusion. And at the same time, they say, well, we can't really limit it, but... And so I can see why someone like Jerry Matetics likes these kind of books, because it's just all about all of this scholarly information without coming to a conviction, without coming to a simple conclusion. And that was actually the cause of the Great Apostasy, because in the decades before Vatican II, these priests and so-called theologians started to think theology too much. They eschewed the simple conclusions. They tried to make things more complex than they are. And as a result, and in the process, their depraved minds explained away the dogmas, including the core dogma, outside the church there is no salvation. Meanwhile, they, in their blind pride, consider themselves so sophisticated, so deep, so learned, when they're actually fools who can't even come to a simple conclusion. I'll give one more quote on this point. There are many, but to further illustrate what I'm talking about, on page 193, Mascavige says, quote, "The limit of subjectivity is determined by the time-honored phrase that to merit the supplatory benefits of Canon 209, it must always be founded upon sufficient reason to gain the assent of a prudent man. As Lamy du Clerge and Crusan agree that it is not always easy to draw with mathematical precision the line between the positive and probable opinion and one that is not such," end quote. And so the conclusion of the reader who believes that they should follow what Mascavige is saying is, oh, well, we just don't know. But no, he has already given the principles which show that you can synthesize these valid principles into a conclusion. And so in conclusion on Mascavige, while he remains in a fog on how to apply the principles he enunciates, he devastates the no jurisdiction position and its advocates by admitting that the church will supply jurisdiction to someone who has not had it before. He admits that the church will supply jurisdiction to someone with colored title, putative title, or even no title in the church. He admits that the church will supply jurisdiction to an undeclared heretic. He says that the burden of proof is upon someone who is attacking the jurisdictional validity of an act in the external forum. He admits that the church will supply jurisdiction in common error, in positive or probable doubt of either law or fact, and that these situations arise if a prudent man is persuaded that they have arisen. He admits that if a prudent man determines that there is a probability of jurisdiction because there is a legitimate doubt of fact or law, then the church will supply jurisdiction in those cases of probability. And while the Great Western Schism was a case primarily of common error and doubt of fact, the situation we're dealing with today is a situation of common error and or doubt of law. And another very important principle in this is one that is called the intrinsic cessation of law. In their commentary on the Code of Canon Law, pages 34 and 35, Buscarin and Ellis explain, quote, "A law may cease to bind in two ways, either by repeal, which is called extrinsic cessation, or by becoming inoperative without repeal, which is called intrinsic cessation. It is common doctrine that a law ceases to bind without repeal in two cases. First, if the circumstances are such that the law has become positively harmful or unreasonable. Second, if the purpose of the law has entirely ceased for the entire community." End quote. So this is an excellent example of how the laws would cease to bind in our situation by virtue of intrinsic cessation of the law. The circumstances are such that the law has become positively harmful for the salvation of souls. There is no valid ordinary to have recourse to. And even in the 1917 Code of Canon Law itself, Canon 15, we see an acknowledgement of this concept. Quote, laws, even invalidating or incapacitating ones, do not bind when there is a doubt of law. When there is a doubt of fact, the ordinary can dispense from them. End quote. So even in the case of an invalidating or incapacitating law, if there is a reasonable doubt of law, they do not bind. And to help illustrate this point, I want to give an actual example of this. And it relates to a controversy among some traditionalists regarding the message of Our Lady of La Salette. As many of our readers know, on September 19, 1846, Our Lady appeared in La Salette, France, and said Rome would lose the faith and become the seat of the Antichrist. It's quite an important prophecy considering what we're dealing with in the post-Vatican II apostasy. But many traditionalists bring up the fact that the Holy Office, in 1915 and in subsequent years, issued decrees which forbade Catholics from interpreting or publishing interpretations of the message of La Salette. And so some people say that when we cite the message of La Salette, or when others do it, that it's basically schismatic or mortally sinful or whatever. And this is another example of legalism gone awry and a false understanding of canon law. To make the point, I need to mention the fact that not many people know that way back in the 16th century, the Fifth Lateran Council had already published a disciplinary decree, about making statements that the Antichrist had arrived. And I wanted to quote this. This is a disciplinary decree from the Fifth Lateran Council, Session 11, December 19, 1516. Quote, they, meaning preachers, are in no way to presume or preach or declare a fixed time for future evils, the coming of Antichrist, or the precise day of judgment, for truth says it is not for us to know the times or the seasons. And certainly no one is saying that we know the day or the hour when the Lord will return, for he says that no man knows that. But the point here is that this was a disciplinary decree in the 16th century which wanted to curb people at that time and abuses where people were saying that the Antichrist was around. Okay, so it was a disciplinary decree intended for those times and circumstances. But obviously when the Antichrist arrives many centuries later, that disciplinary decree wouldn't necessarily bind. And so even if it hasn't been specifically revoked, it has passed out of usefulness. It's an example of an intrinsic cessation of a law. And the same thing would apply to the Holy Office decree in the year 1915, which forbade interpreting and publishing and commenting upon the message of La Salette. They wanted to stop people or prevent people from saying that Rome was the seat of the Antichrist at that time. And you can understand how a true pope would want to do that. He wouldn't want people concluding or thinking that maybe Rome was the seat of the Antichrist while he was reigning. But many years later, when you're dealing with a man in Rome who is actually proclaiming himself the Christ, the Son of the living God, as John Paul II did in his first homily, preaching a completely new gospel, declaring that the gospel is man, overturning the whole Catholic faith, well then obviously you're in a completely different circumstance where you're confronted front and center with Antichrist in Rome. Whether you think he is the definitive fulfillment of the Antichrist or not, you are definitely dealing with Antichrist in Rome. And so that decree of the Holy Office was a disciplinary decree intended for that time, and it doesn't bind when the obvious fulfillment of what Our Lady was talking about is right in our face. It's an example of intrinsic cessation of the law. And so the people who try to denounce those who are utilizing for the good the message and the startling prophecy that Our Lady made, which fits so perfectly with what is going on, are simply of bad will and misled. It's legalism gone awry. And what's ironic about this is that Jerry Mannetix, this who has become this legalistic Pharisee and schismatic advocate of this no jurisdiction nonsense, he quotes the message of La Salette and uses it as if it's been fulfilled. He will point out that she said Rome will lose the faith and become the seat of the Antichrist. Well, if he wants to follow the strict laws, he shouldn't do that because the Holy Office forbade people from commenting upon it. So he violates the laws he wants to violate, and there will be more on that. And it's also interesting that in the very same decree it talked about how people are not to publish religious works. I want to quote that. In the very same Holy Office decree from 1915, it said, let people be subject to the sanctions given both by Pope Leo XIII through the constitution of the offices and responsibilities against those who publish books dealing with religious things without legitimate permission of superiors, end quote. So, again, you have all of these no-jurisdiction hypocrites who are completely refuted by the facts that I've covered, who publish books without permission, which is a violation, strictly speaking, of canon law. Well, they say, no, those laws have ceased, so they apply either epikaya or intrinsic cessation of the law, or whatever they want to call it, to the things they want to do, publish books, preach, etc. But all these other things, which are necessary for the salvation of souls, such as having priests to forgive sins, forget about it. That's not allowed. It's purely hypocritical. They're condemned out of their own mouths. And so God is not forbidding the faithful to acknowledge the fulfillment of Rome losing the faith and becoming the seat of the Antichrist when it's obviously right in our face. That was a law not intended for this circumstance.